rock band The Sound on Take It From Us as our theme tune for our mental health radio program. They're a trio of Kiwi musicians, two of whom are mental health consumers. Let's listen to some more of their track, Long Gone. To Take It From Us on what is a big day for the show today, and I'll explain a little about that in just a couple of moments. As you know, Take It From Us is brought to you by Framework and the Like Minds, Like Mind campaign. I'm your host, Sheldon Brown, and Take It From Us is the voice of mental health on Planet FM and addresses reducing stigma and discrimination against people with lived experience of mental distress. And stigma and discrimination is a very big barrier, of course, to recovery. Today's broadcast, it's a personal challenge for me, as our guest is an esteemed clinical psychologist with as much as 20 years' experience with people experiencing psychosis. He's also been a manager of mental health services, but since 1994, he's been a member of the Auckland University's Department of Psychology. He's the coordinating editor of a book which is called Models of Madness as well, and I believe has recently coordinated the editing of a more recent book as well. Our guest, Professor John Reed, has been described as a, quote, controversial academic and a critic of mainstream medical, psychiatric and psychological opinions, and especially schizophrenia. He's a healthy skepticism towards the pharmaceutical industry, which I guess I would share as well. And he believes that industry exercises too much influence over research and mental health services. He's also on the executive board of the International Society for the Psychological Treatments of Schizophrenia, and in 2010 he received the New Zealand Psychological Society's Sir Thomas Hunter Award for excellence in scholarship, research and professional achievement. So John, welcome to Take It From Us. I hope that's an accurate summary.
Thank you, Sheldon. That's very flattering, and it's a pleasure to be here. I think it's a wonderful program providing an excellent service to the community.
So oh, thank
thanks
you.
For having me.
Well, it's been a few weeks and months of just negotiating the right time, and I'm feeling bad that you jumped on a municipal bus to get here. I could have picked you up.
Oh, that's fine. The bus was actually on time, which is amazing.
Unlike the experience of our previous guest, I was telling you, I had to pick him up in Pakuranga because the bus didn't turn up. I've read your view that attempts to combat stigma and discrimination with this approach, and I quote, mental illness is an illness like any other approach, actually increases fear and prejudice. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, what we find when we look at the research all over the world is that the more people believe that mental health problems and emotional distress and despair and so forth, the more they think of them in illness terms, the worse their attitudes are. And that's sort of directly contrary to most destigmatization programs, which tend to try and teach the public that mental illness is an illness like any other. That's a whole other issue, whether it is an illness, and we can come on to that later perhaps, because I don't think of human reactions to life events as illnesses. But putting that on one side, all the research says that the more you teach the public to think these are illnesses with biological causes like genetic predispositions and biochemical imbalances, the more frightened they become of these people, and the more prejudiced, and the more they want to keep their distance from them. So we're kind of spending money in the hope that this idea will improve attitudes, but it's not evidence-based, it's not research-based, it's actually making it worse.
Do you think people are still out there think that you can catch mental illness from someone?
Oh, not too many these days, I hope. It's more to do with if we... The reason it makes it worse, we're not so sure about that. We are sure it makes it worse, this illness idea. It makes attitudes worse, but we don't really know why. One of the lead theories as to why is that it exaggerates the differences, the you and me sort of, or us and them sort of situation. Because if you say, if I say to you, Sheldon, if I do something strange, and then I say, well, that's actually because of something different about my brain from yours, that actually doesn't make you sort of want to get closer. That makes you sort of take a couple of steps back. Because it makes people seem as if they're sort of from another species. You know, they've got different genes, their brains are different from normal people. It actually doesn't help.
But so we're accepting of the word illness. It's when we put mental with the word illness that suddenly it generates fear.
That's right. Well, of course, there are real illnesses. No one would dispute that. With real physiological causes, you know, medical-type biological causes and medical-type solutions. It's just that model has sort of crept over into the area of human distress and despair and confusion and taken over that area, really, when there really isn't a lot of evidence to show that these things are biologically based illnesses at all.
Are we making progress towards acceptance of mental health problems rather than talking about mental illness?
That's a gradual process. I think we are getting there. There's some vested interests, though, who are very keen that we hold on to this illness idea. You mentioned earlier the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, clearly, and I don't blame them for this, it's their job to sell their products like any other business. So they're going to be keen to fund any programs that use the illness model, that try to teach the public to think in illness terms, and to convince people that when you're depressed, there's something wrong with your brain, rather than you're depressed because something depressing just happened. Which is my rather simple theory of what causes depression. So the pharmaceutical companies are going to fight tooth and nail to keep that illness perspective, that biological orientation. Yeah.
Well, your colleague Richard Bentall, who was here in the studio some time ago, and you know, captured a lot of exposure, media exposure at the time that he was here. He made the point about the DCM,
the diagnostic manual,
yeah. That they're producing more and more illnesses in order to sell more and more drugs.
Yes, I think he has a point there. I mean, let's take a couple of examples. We used to call people who are sort of a bit scared of other people, we used to call them shy, didn't we? And now they have social anxiety disorder. We used to call that feeling we have when somebody dies, we used to call it grief or sadness. Now it's depressive disorder. We used to call kids who really don't take much notice of grown-ups when told what to do naughty. Now they have conduct disorder. And you note the disorder after everything. Sort of this implies this illness thing. There's something wrong with the individual, it's located in the individual rather than the circumstances around them. So yes, I think Professor Bentall has a good point there, and he says that we have created, well, it's 650 pages worth, actually. My favorite one, just should just get it in while I can. My favourite one of all is intermittent explosive disorder.
Which
we used to call beating the crap out of people every so often.
All right.
But now it's intermittent explosive disorder. So there are some other silly examples.
So does anger fall in under that intermittent explosive disorder?
That's right. That would be in there as well. Yeah.
And it need to be medicated.
I don't know if they've come up with a medication for that one. I'm sure they're working on it somewhere. But on a more serious note, while we're talking about the sort of creation of illnesses and disorders, one of the biggest issues in New Zealand at the moment is for children. The massive increase in the last 5 years around of the number of our kids who have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. It's just gone completely off the scale. And this is a great concern to many of us. It seems to become the first explanation when a kid is struggling at school, usually boys, because that particular diagnosis is three times more common in boys than girls. That now seems to be the first sort of explanation. It's not that the kid's got some worries or something's upsetting them at home or they're not getting on with the teacher or those things tend to be not explored like perhaps they used to be now. Well, the kid's got ADHD, so the solution is get them on Ritalin.
So is that a misdiagnosis? I mean, are you saying that too many are being diagnosed with this official sort of name or label?
Yeah, so we're undoubtedly over-diagnosing that particular one. These things are sort of, they come in fads and trends, and that seems to be the in thing at the moment, and often I think the diagnosis probably isn't being done carefully enough or properly enough. I mean, there's no doubt that there are kids who really do struggle to sit still and concentrate and do need some help with that. I'm not sure medication is the right way to help kids to sit still and concentrate, especially when the medication does things like reduce average growth per year by 1 centimeter, for instance. So these are quite serious, heavy medical solutions that we're putting into our kids. So, but to come back to the diagnosis, to do it properly, the kid has to show these behaviors in more than one situation. So often you'll get a kid that's, you know, climbing the walls at school, but is perfectly fine at home, or the other way around. And that tells you immediately where the problem lies, perhaps. Mm. And it's all too tempting to just sort of say there's something wrong, and or even more so, there's something sort of biologically wrong with little Johnny or Susie.
Have you got any insights, though, into why there does appear to be a greater incidence of these attention deficit disorders in children?
Well, I don't think there is a greater incidence. I think it's not like suddenly New Zealand kids have started becoming extraordinarily naughty in the last 5 years or struggling to concentrate more than they were 5 years ago. I think you'll see there's been a major push, largely from the drug companies, to promote this whole idea. I mean, the drug companies are very, very efficient at promoting this whole set of ideas around distress being an illness, as we've talked about before. So it can't be that suddenly there are five times more disturbed kids in New Zealand. That just doesn't make sense, I don't think. So they've managed to persuade our doctors and, to some extent, our teachers to think in these terms, when previously they would have looked at, you know, what's going on at home, what's going on in the school, is there some bullying going on? There's a whole raft of reasons why young kids end up distressed and finding it difficult to concentrate. They may just be bored to death. Some kids find school extraordinarily boring.
But, I mean, there's those generalizations that kids are playing PlayStation, they're not getting out and climbing trees and falling out of trees and doing their trampolining and sports and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, don't kids need to let off some steam?
Oh, I think they do. Yes, that might be part of the picture. I think we react a little bit too quickly, certainly in terms of how we label kids. Rather than, as I say, exploring what's going on in their lives, and God forbid, asking them what they think might be the problem. You know, 7-year-olds can talk. Seven-year-olds can think. Seven-year-olds have their explanation as to, if you can establish a relationship with them, they'll tell you, well, I'm doing this because of A, B, and C, and that's what I need some help with. But all too often, we actually don't ask them.
There's a lot of publicity out of America and other countries that we're also medicating children very young for things like depression and anxiety and that sort of thing. Is that a major concern of yours?
Yes, it is. We're not doing that too much in New Zealand yet. I hope that doesn't come here. We're doing a fairly good job of holding a line there. It's just beginning to creep. Antidepressants are beginning to creep into the teenage years, but we haven't seen a lot of the younger kids, you know, the under 10s, as is the case in America. America's an appallingly biological approach to all of these issues. New Zealand's sort of middle of the road on that, so we're no sort of about average, but America just medicates anything that moves, including, you know, young kids at an appallingly early age.
And what does that reflect? Does that reflect the control that the pharmaceutical drug companies have over the GPs or the medical profession generally?
Yes, I think they certainly have more influence in America than in most countries. Almost all the professional training that doctors get, and I don't just mean psychiatrists now, I mean all doctors, after they qualify, almost all of the postgraduate professional training is provided by drug companies. And you can't expect them to provide objective, evidence-based training when it's in their interest to portray whatever the issue is, depression or young kids running about uncontrollably or people with high anxiety. You can't expect them to portray what the research actually says, for instance, about the social causes of those things. They're going to say it's a biological phenomenon. They're going to say it's a chemical imbalance. They're going to say there's genetic predispositions. And so would I. If I was a drug company executive accountable to my shareholders, that's what I would do. So I don't actually blame the drug companies. I have a concern with psychiatry's inability yet to establish a proper ethical professional boundary between themselves and the drug companies. That's coming gradually. They're just waking up in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. The fact that they can't have all their research journals and their conferences funded by the pharmaceutical industry without paying a price.
You know, I guess there would be a perception too that there are some monetary incentives for prescribers to prescribe particular drugs.
Not directly. There's some subtle influences, you know, free samples and those sorts of things. Not in New Zealand, anyway. I'm sure that goes on in America, but no, I don't think we're getting anything close to what we would call direct sort of bribes from the drug companies. Mm-hmm. They hand out all sorts of freebies all over the place, but they're not directly linked to if you prescribe more of this medication. They haven't quite gone that far in this country.
Mm. I mean, you touched on depression in young people. I understand that depression is now the world's third most common illness. Do you think we're handling its treatment well in New Zealand?
No, we're not. I'm afraid that's another area where we're doing fairly well, as I say, at not medicating the youngsters. In terms of adults, the last Ministry of Health statistics show that in 2009, 1 in 10 adult New Zealanders had been prescribed antidepressants in the previous year. And as is the case all around the world, the rates are twice as high for women as for men, which is an interesting issue we could perhaps come back to. But so that means 1 in 7 of adult New Zealand women were prescribed antidepressants. Now, what's that about?
I would have thought women were much better in talking about these issues and coming clean about them and sharing them and networking with their other woman friends and that sort of thing.
That's true, and they're also quicker than us guys to go to the GP and acknowledge that, look, I'm feeling pretty down, doctor. So that's part of why they're prescribed it more often, because they're more willing to talk about it. to their friends, but also to the GP, whereas us guys will say, you know, it's no problem, or it's not a worry, or the women go to the GPs, the guys go down the pub. Medicate themselves in a different manner.
Which is not good for depression.
No, it isn't, actually. Short term it is, because it makes you feel good for about 2 or 3 hours. The next morning's not so hot, no. But that rate is, so just leave the gender issue aside for 1 minute, one in 10 New Zealanders on antidepressants. Now, that either means that one in 10 New Zealanders are severely depressed, in which case we need to be looking at what's going on in New Zealand. You know, what's that about? And I'm not sure that's the case. I think, again, a better explanation is that we've this increase, and it is a steady increase up to 1 in 10. We are pretty close now to American levels of antidepressant prescription. And again, I suggest that's a pushing of the idea that sadness and grief are illnesses that are caused by a biochemical imbalance. I mean, that's out there in public discussion. You know, it's a chemical imbalance. Well, let's take this situation. You lose somebody, a lifetime partner, for instance, and you feel very, very sad and lost, and you're grieving and so forth. You can, at that point, come along and researchers do this to show that the cause of depression is biological. They come along at that point when somebody's depressed after something depressing has happened and show that the brain is operating differently at that point. And they can look at serotonin and dopamine and so forth. And they will find that difference. Now, what has caused the depression? The loss of your loved one, or your brain acting differently? Because the brain is responding to the loss as well. But the argument comes in, if you can find this chemical difference in the brain, then that's the cause of the depression, and that's what needs correcting. And that is just, I mean, to use a not too polite term, that's just very silly.
There is quite a lot of controversy around this whole issue of chemical imbalance, isn't there? I mean, is it a reality?
It isn't, no. Well, when I say it isn't, I mean, as I say, you can find brain differences between two groups of people. That doesn't mean that we're dealing primarily with a biological phenomenon, because the brain is designed to react to the environment, right? And some brain researchers seem to lose sight of that, and they find a difference between, say, depressed people and non-depressed people, and say, now we've found the cause of depression. Let's plug in the medication that supposedly corrects this chemical imbalance.
And gives you a bit more serotonin in the brain or something.
That's right. But as I say, that chemical imbalance, and it's a temporary one, usually, has been caused by a depressing event in the environment. So we're not dealing with it. Yes, there's a biological phenomenon there, but that's not the cause of it. The cause of it is the depressing event that's happened, and that's what needs addressing. And no chemical can actually really properly address that, I don't think.
So are we not giving time for people to adapt to that grief and that very sad occasion, and just allowing them to do other things rather than run along and get some pills?
I think that's right. I mean, it's a horrible cliche, isn't it? But time is a great healer. And there's nothing wrong or abnormal with feeling sad or low or blue, or call it what you like, call it depressed if you must. There's nothing wrong with that when depressing things are going on in your life. And I don't think we want to create a species where we never actually feel grief when loss occurs, and we all immediately rush off to the GP and say, I'm terribly sad because my partner's died and I don't want to feel like this, can you stop it? Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily the GP's fault, because a lot of people do go in asking for that and put the GPs under considerable pressure. And the GPs have about, 10, 12 minutes to listen to everybody's problems. So it's not a matter of blaming. Well, it's not blaming anybody, really. We've got to collectively pull ourselves out of this mess we've gotten ourselves in for. I mean, I hear horror stories. People lose their jobs and immediately on antidepressants. The cat dies, antidepressants. Having mentioned cats, some people are actually prescribing Prozac to their dogs at the moment, but that's a whole nother. We won't go there.
Well, you can insure your pets via the warehouse, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a music break, and we'll give John a little bit of a rest, because I think he may have just a little bit of an issue with talking too much in terms of his throat. So we've got a track here from Narita Murdoch called Many Lines. We've played it a number of times on Take It From Us, and it comes from the Soul Project CD. This is Take It From Us, and we're talking to Professor John Reid from the Auckland University's Department of Psychology, and we've been talking about some of the downsides, some of the critical issues, I guess. We've been a little bit negative on the pharmaceutical companies and that sort of thing, but there are other options and alternatives, John. What are some of those that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, there's a range of alternatives, and I guess I should say first, I'm not personally, although I get portrayed as this, understandably, I'm not anti-medication. I'm anti a mental health system that sort of doesn't give equal emphasis to different types of approaches and doesn't give people choices. So currently we tend to have a medicate first and talk to the person about what the problem is later. So that's what I'm against. So, and I think we're slowly moving towards a situation where people are given more choices, but we've got a ways to go. And we have to do that partly because of the most recent research coming out that is showing, if we look at antidepressants, for instance, for 95% of people currently on antidepressants, they don't actually work.
95%?
95%. Well, when I say they don't work, what the research is showing us is that they're no more effective than placebo. So they might work for some of that 95%, but it's not because of the chemical involved in the pill. It's that expectation of hope and recovery that comes with the pill. And there's nothing wrong with placebo. I think a lot of what us psychologists do is placebo, is instilling hope. And really, as soon as you do anything, you take any action, whether it's taking a pill or talking to a psychologist or exercising more or anything, once you've taken the decision, I'm going to do something about this and this is what I'm going to do, you actually tend to immediately feel better regardless of whether it's a pill or a psychologist or whatever. But the problem with a lot of the medications is that they do have rather worrying adverse effects, which I won't go on about because I don't want to be too negative. The point is, if they worked because of placebo without the adverse effects, then there wouldn't be a problem. But a lot of them, especially in my area of psychosis, they have quite terrible side effects. So let's move on to the alternatives. But saying first of all, I think that nobody should start a medication or come off a medication or change the medication on the basis of listening to one person on one radio show. I just need to say that. So if anything I'm saying today gives you concerns about your medication, don't make any changes, of course. Go talk to your GP or the prescriber and discuss those concerns with them. I just need to say that. So in terms of alternatives, there's a whole range of, let's take depression, things that do work for depression, and you've already identified one, Sheldon, and that's sort of doing nothing for a little while, accepting that you're feeling depressed or sad, and that's a normal response very often to life events. It doesn't feel very good. Nobody likes feeling sad, especially if it goes on for days or weeks, but sometimes we just have to accept, look, this is a depressing time in my life, and that's how I feel, and that's part of being human, whether we like it or not. But if we feel that we're getting stuck, and it's becoming intolerable, then there's a whole bunch of things we can do without taking medication. And for my own field, the research is strongest around something called cognitive therapy, which most people are somewhat familiar with now, and that's based on the rather simple idea that part of why we stay depressed for a long time, if we do, is because of the things we tell ourselves about ourselves. Yes, depression is primarily caused by depressing things happening, but two people experiencing the same depressing event, one might feel down for a couple of days and one might feel down 3 or 4 weeks later. So what's that about? And what we find, perhaps unsurprisingly, is that it's largely to do with the sorts of things we tell ourselves. So if something bad happens, we have a range of options. We can blame other people, we can say it's bad luck, we can say it's fate, or we can say, well, I'm just really quite a bad person, or I deserved that, or so we all have each of us has one or two sort of negative thoughts like that that we tend to use over and over again whenever a bad thing happens. They occur just underneath consciousness. I don't mean deep down sort of psychoanalytic type unconscious. I mean just underneath consciousness. So the trick is to try and catch them. My particular negative self-statement that has been bugging me all my life is that I'm stupid. So when something bad happens, the immediate thought, I'm stupid. Why didn't I know that was going to happen? What's wrong with me? Like, and any normal, intelligent person would have figured that out.
Can you give us an example of that?
It's fairly, I'm just trying to think now. I'm in the middle of doing a series of undergraduate lectures at the minute, and I can't think of exactly what but I did say something that was not helpful, and afterwards I beat myself up for about half an hour about why you've been giving these lectures all this time. You are just thick. You're stupid. You never learn, do you?
But you're a professor and an academic.
That's kind of the point, Sheldon. These things are irrational thoughts. I mean, I'm not Einstein, but I'm not thick. But I tell myself I am at times of stress, and we all have one or two thoughts like that. For some people, it's I'm ugly, I'm unlovable, and we all have a little special one just for ourselves that we beat ourselves up with.
How do you counter that then?
Well, the first thing is trying to catch them, and you can do that by sort of carrying a little notepad around with you for a few days and trying to. You have to put a bit of work into it. Whenever you feel a bit down, try and catch what it is you're telling yourself. And the first time, perhaps you won't be able to, but after two or three efforts, you'll find there's a thought there, and then you'll find it's the same one over and over again. Or some of us have two themes we beat ourselves up with. And then the trick after that is to replace them with something sensible, not the opposite. So in my case, it would not be helpful to say, well, actually, I'm the most intelligent person in the world. That's dumb. Just tell yourself, in my case, it would be, well, I'm pretty good at something some of the time. Or I guess I could just remind myself I am a professor, so I suppose that might help. But it's just having something to just replace it with is quite helpful. This takes effort. I'm not saying this is an easy thing to do. It takes a lot more effort than swallowing a pill. That's right. Why the pills are so attractive, is because you've got to put a bit of work into these things.
But there are no side effects from this positive self-talk.
Not physical. There's one side effect which some people do, so I'll warn them about that now. Some people, when we psychologists do cognitive therapy, occasionally, when they finally get this idea that they've been beating themselves up for a long time with all these negative thoughts, they go, oh my God, not only am I depressed, but I'm one of those stupid people that beats themselves up with negative thoughts. So what you have to do there is kind of figure out where those thoughts came from. Because there isn't a gene for telling yourself you're stupid or ugly. These thoughts come from somewhere, right? And surprise, surprise, they come from our childhoods. And mum and dad meaning well, but telling us at a cross moment, telling us we're stupid or we're ugly or whatever. Or a teacher. It does kind of help to figure out where the thoughts come from, so you don't beat yourself up for beating yourself up.
Mm. Yeah. So that sort of takes us to the sort of trauma that we may have experienced at a young age, and the sexual abuse or the physical abuse. Have these been understated, do you think, in the diagnoses in mental health?
We have been rather slow over the decades to understand the full extent of how, when bad things happen early enough in childhood, how they can have long-lasting effects. I think we have pretty much finally got there now. But it did take us a long time. And the research coming out now showing that whatever the mental health disorder, childhood physical abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, are all highly predictive of a range of things, from depression and anxiety disorders, obviously post-traumatic stress disorder, that should be no surprise. But what's perhaps more surprising is in my own area of psychosis and schizophrenia, it's highly predictive of that as well, and that's for some people a little bit controversial, because those are supposed to be really biological illness type thing. But across the board, yeah, these things are highly predictive, and that's why we spent quite a lot of time here in Auckland, especially at Auckland DHB, training mental health staff to make sure they do ask about those sorts of things when people are admitted to mental health services. Because surprisingly, when we did research about 12 years ago, we found that it was quite rare for mental health professionals to ask people about what had gone on in their childhoods. And Auckland District Health Board took the lead on that and introduced 10 years ago a policy that everybody must be asked and that the staff must be trained. So we put together a training package, which has now been used for 10 years or so. Because I think part of the reason we don't like to ask is it's kind of...
very personal.
It is personal, but it's also kind of upsetting to hear some of the stories. And mental health professionals are people too. And so we sometimes don't go into those messy, painful places. Because if you ask everybody, you're going to hear a lot of really unpleasant stuff. But it's our job to do that. So it's been really good to see those changes coming about. And exciting thing, a couple of years ago, the National Health Service in the United Kingdom introduced pretty much the same policy as Auckland had pioneered here. And I was invited over to train the first 100 psychiatrists in London on how to do that, when to ask, how to ask, and perhaps most importantly, how to respond when somebody does tell you these awful things have happened.
So those very personal questions, are you advocating that they should be asked right up front in the first session?
Yeah, most of the time. Sometimes, obviously, if somebody's acutely suicidal or very, very distressed, and that's not the right time, obviously, to ask them about those sorts of things. But either at the first encounter or pretty soon thereafter when the person's settled down. Otherwise, what you do is you send a message to people that it's kind of not safe to tell, because I'm not one of the people that get this, that think it's important. If you take sexual abuse, for instance, and childhood sexual abuse, the average amount of time it takes someone who was sexually abused as a child to tell anybody is about 15, 16 years. There's all sorts of shame and self-blame and or protecting the family if it took place inside the family. So people don't spontaneously reveal these things. You have to actually ask them. Yeah.
You've touched on the fact that one of your specialty areas is psychosis, and we were talking before the interview about sort of how that label is a bit fearful and generates fear, doesn't it? I mean, is there a simple description of psychosis?
The problem is that we've lumped lots of things together. So the term psychosis or the term schizophrenia, we lump a lot of different experiences together, and that isn't helpful. So what is helpful, both in terms of researching the causes of things and also in terms of reducing stigma, is to actually describe the actual experience. So instead of psychosis, for instance, psychosis has many parts to it, so why don't we just talk about people who hear voices, voice hearers, for instance.
Are they one and the same? Can I just interrupt there?
Not exactly, because voice hearing is one, from a medical perspective or a diagnostic perspective, it's one symptom of psychosis or of schizophrenia. It's one of the most prominent ones, and the other one would be delusions. When we start breaking it down into its component parts, we start getting much more useful research about what causes these things, because what causes someone to hear voices is not the same thing as what causes them to have delusions or to have thought disorder or any of these other things. They're actually specific experiences. But sadly, we've lumped all these things together. And then we wonder why we can't find the cause for them, biological or social. But yes, you're right. The term schizophrenia and psychosis is very, very stigmatizing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, let's take another music break and give John a bit of a break in talking as well. And we've got another track off the Soul Project to play here.
I don't think it
Take It From Us, and we're talking to Professor John Reid of Auckland University's Department of Psychology, and fairly serious issues that we've raised with John, and one of them he's touched on is schizophrenia. It's clearly a focus of his work and research, and a thrust of the editing work that you did on the book Models of Madness. What's your principal conclusion about schizophrenia, John?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we've been getting it wrong for quite a long time by, as I said earlier, grouping together a whole bunch of different types of experiences and calling them something and then thinking we've understood it. So the standard explanation goes, well, someone's hearing voices. Why are they hearing voices? Well, they've got schizophrenia. But that isn't really an explanation for why they're hearing voices. It's just a word that describes it. People hear voices for a whole range of different reasons. There's a lot of research now suggesting that these experiences are very often an understandable reaction to life events. So I guess an obvious example would be where people are hearing the voice of somebody who did something fairly unpleasant to them as a child, without going into the gory details. This is not at all uncommon. But because it's an unpleasant thing to recall, the person hears the voice and then experiences it not part of themselves, but experiences it as out there in the world. Nothing to do with me. I don't know who this person is or why I'm hearing this. It's out there. And that defends them against remembering the awful experiences, But then they've got this other problem of they're now hearing a voice from outside. You know, it's kind of interesting that when people hear voices, if you put a microphone up against their vocal cords, are moving. Or if you put them in a brain scan, which is probably not a good idea when someone's hearing a voice, but where we have done those sorts of studies, we find that the speech area of the brain lights up. This is quite useful in helping people understand that these things are actually internal experiences. They are memories. They're internally generated events. And this is a more helpful approach, you know, to getting people to think about why they might be hearing that particular voice, what it means in relation to their life experiences, rather than the standard approach for the last 50 years or so of saying, this voice does not exist, it doesn't mean anything, except that there's something wrong with your brain and you've got this illness called schizophrenia and we're going to stop it.
By medication.
It's understandable because a lot of mental health professionals get a bit frightened, highly anxious when somebody says, I'm hearing voices, which is not helpful to the person hearing a voice. What they need is somebody to sit calmly with them and listen and help them slowly sort of figure out what it might mean in their life.
I imagine, though, that the person who hears voices also could become very anxious and fearful and wondering how long this is going to go on and how much it's going to disrupt their life and that sort of thing. And that fear is often not helpful in mental health, is it? In our own mental health.
That's right. In fact, you've hit on the best predictor of who ends up as a psychiatric patient for a long time after the first time they've heard voices. It's actually relatively common. About between 10 and 15% of people in every culture where it's been measured, where there have been surveys, will hear voices at some point in their life. But only a small percentage of those go on to become labeled schizophrenic or become psychiatric patients. And the primary predictor is exactly what you just said there. The level of distress you have the first time you hear voices, and what determines that is what you tell yourself about the voice, a little bit like the cognitive stuff we were talking about before. So if you say, oh, that's interesting, maybe I've got a bit of a gift here, for instance, you're not going to get distressed, you're not going to end up in the hospital. If you tell yourself, oh my God, I'm going mad, you're going to get more distressed. You're going to then stop trying, you're going to work very hard to suppress the voices, which means you hear them more often, because there's one thing you can't do with a thought or an experience, you can't suppress it. If you want to try this at home, just try not to think, after we get off the air, try not to think about the term white elephant for 1 minute. And all you will do is think about the term white elephant. So you try and suppress the voices, so you hear them more, you get more and more distressed, and then you end up sort of being diagnosed schizophrenic. So if you can remember, for people who do hear voices, or if you have a friend who hears voices, if you can remember, first of all, it's relatively common. Lots of people hear voices. It's just that we're a bit embarrassed to talk about it. And secondly, it does not mean you're mad or there's something wrong with your brain. It can mean a whole range of different things. And just I think it's worth stressing that most people who do hear voices hear as many positive voices as negative ones. A lot of people hear voices supporting them, encouraging them to carry on and giving them advice, and sometimes good advice, sometimes not so good advice. But right. It's a whole range of voices, but it doesn't mean you're mad and it doesn't mean there's something wrong with your brain.
Well, we're going into our community notices on Take It From Us, and we've got a special feature that we've developed over the last week or so.
Take It From Us Community Notice Board. Thanks to the Like Minds Like Mind campaign and framework.
Well, one of the things that I do want to promote is the James King exhibition. Some of the listeners will remember that James was our co-host on Take It From Us, and his pictures are promoted at the Depot Art Space in Devonport. That's 28 Clarence Street. The exhibition will run until the 19th of May. It opened last Saturday, and so get along to that exhibition. The quote here from Toyora that is set up this exhibition says that the pictures are about the politics of life. there's grief and anger, and that's one of the things that we've been talking to our guest John Reed about, embedded in these works. I hope there is also compassion, empathy, and an attempt at least to think beyond. And that's a quote from James himself. And James is getting on reasonably well down in Dunedin. I've heard from him just recently. But get along to his exhibition at the Depot Art Space, 28 Clarence Street, Devonport. I think that's right on the waterfront in Devonport. Runs until Thursday, the 19th of May. Well, that's been Take It From Us. I think we've probably got time just for one more question. Was there something that you wanted to finish the show with, John? Something perhaps a positive? You finished with some very positive comment about hearing voices, and we had Aaron Pearson on. I think he was the first guest I had when I took over this job, and he said he used to make an appointment with his voices.
Yeah, Aaron is a wonderful fella. Yeah, no, you can do that sort of thing. I guess I should end with sort of just paying a tribute to the, because I'm sometimes critical of our mental health services, but there's no doubt that the majority of people working in the mental health field, certainly in New Zealand, are doing a very good job. They're labouring, I think, under a model that, as I say, is too medicalised. But the majority of them, the nurses, psychologists, the social workers, the OTs, and I have to say many of the psychiatrists, are slowly moving towards this more recovery model. They're slowly letting go of the labelling and drugging first approach. And I think this is wonderful to watch. And I think programs like this, and I like the Nutters Club on Radio Live. And Maori Television, and the Like Minds campaign overall is all playing its part in this very gradual process towards a more humane and more effective mental health services. It's a struggle, but we're getting there.
And a more enlightened attitude.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, next week on Take It From Us, we're going to reveal the facts about suicide, in fact, and particularly youth suicide, a story that maybe is not being told in New Zealand. So we've got Maria Bradshaw from Casper, who did an interview with us during the week when she was in a camping ground in Taranaki. So that's Take It From Us. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Tuesday at 12:30.